Accession number 7328, roll number 1.
Colonel Young, reel 1. Colonel, can I ask you to give me a brief account of your military background and experience before you were associated with 52 Middle East Commando?
Well, I started my military career as a gentleman cadet at the shop, RMA Woolwich in those days, and that went on for 2 years. After that, having been commissioned, we went to Chatham and did a further 2 years there as second lieutenants on the technical side of the sapper's work, having to qualify in some engineering degree in order to get our corps pay at the end of our engineering course.
Where did you do your degree? Was that at Cambridge?
No, unfortunately, the Cambridge course started about 3 years after I was commissioned. And that would have been a very pleasant experience, which I was very disappointed at missing. In those days, the cadets, after commissioning, did 2 full years at Cambridge and took the BA, Mechanical Science Tripos, and in between whiles, like the long vac and so on, they were taken down to Chatham and went on with their military engineering subjects, such as bridging and things like that. And at the same time, the shop course was reduced to 18 months from 2 years, so the entire training of the sapper officer from the time he joined to the as a cadet to when he was let loose on soldiers was about 4.5 years, of which the last two, of course, he was a commissioned officer. After that, I did a couple of years training recruits in the training battalion, which I don't think was a very good arrangement, because I knew at the beginning just about as much as the chaps I was trying to teach, which was nothing. But it was good practical experience in learning to deal with all sorts and conditions of men, as you might say. Then after that, I had a splendid posting. I got into a British field company which was serving in Egypt. In those days, there were only two field companies, British, abroad. All the others were fortress companies and so on. The Indian equivalent, of course, the Sapper and Miner Company, had British officers, but no troops. The troops were all Indian. So I had a splendid 5 years in Egypt altogether. Three I was a company subaltern, and the remaining two I was a garrison engineer. A very interesting station to be in, because there was a complete cavalry brigade there, two battalions of the Cairo Brigade infantry, horse artillery regiment, and all the usual administrative details. And the both field companies were always very heavily employed, because we were so few for the amount of other troops. I mean, we were always being asked for manoeuvres to put up water points and make tracks and things of that sort.
So you were out in the field a lot?
Oh, yes. We reckoned the 3 months, more or less, training season, we spent entirely out of barracks in the camps or just living in the desert. And it was a splendid unit to be in, because the rank and file did 5 years in it, and after about 2 full training seasons, there was nothing about field engineering, really, that they didn't know. Even the the rank-and-file sapper, quite apart from the non-commissioned officers. And I found it a splendid unit to be in, because you could so easily, having decided what to do, give it to some corporal, lance corporal even, and say, look, you three chaps, you've got to put up a water point there for a cavalry regiment or something like that, which is quite a feat. And they would often do it without any sort of further instruction.
It must have been very useful for purposes of assessment.
Well, it had to be, really, because, I mean, if we couldn't get the sort of standard of training right through down to the lowest level, the thing was folded up and people would have been out without their water and so forth. And then the final 2 years I was there, I was garrison engineer of the one part of the Abbasia cantonment where the bulk of these chaps lived, and I learnt a good deal there of how other ranks and in other units got on, because I knew all the barracks intimately and so on, because I was responsible for them and the training grounds and ranges and so on and so forth. And though garrison engineering was fairly unpopular with the sapper subaltern, it was a very worthwhile job to have done from the simply by learning, putting your what you learnt in practice at Chatham, in paper Chatham, into practice. I then had the good fortune at the end of my 5 years in the Middle East to be chosen for a language course in Russian, which started at the beginning of 1934. And after 3 months' preliminary study in London, I was sent off to Riga in the Baltic States and did the rest of the year there, living in a Russian emigre family whom I got very attached. They were all much older than I was and treated me rather as the son of the house, as you might say. And I enjoyed that very much, though I had to work very hard in order to reach interpretership standard, which I had to get in pain of losing a certain amount of money if I didn't. And it's not an easy language for an adult to learn, because it's quite unlike French or English or many other languages. It has to be declined, conjugated as you go along, which makes it very difficult for an Englishman. Once you reach the standard of being able to think that way, it becomes easier and easier as you go along. It's merely a question of picking up enough words to have a reasonable vocabulary. But until you reach that stage, which took me about 6 months altogether, it's hard labour, no question about it. However, having passed that, I was then, unfortunately, unable to get a temporary posting to the Military Intelligence Department in the War Office, which was the usual thing after a language course, so that you could consolidate your language, having the threat of exam not hanging over your head any longer. And if by any chance you'd failed in the exam, you still had a few months which you could study and take it again. But fortunately, I didn't have to do that, but I couldn't get a posting to the War Office, and so I was sent off to Chatham as garrison engineer originally, and after 6 months I was posted to the School of Military Engineering as an assistant instructor in the Fieldworks and Bridging School, There were four schools in the School of Military Engineering in those days: survey, construction, electrical and mechanical, and fieldworks and bridging, of which the first three were almost entirely technical, and the fieldworks and bridging was, of course, teaching what would be expected of a field engineer with a divisional formation. I happened to be given the section that dealt with heavy bridge construction, which I found intensely interesting, though it's very difficult in a course of that sort to have time to do much of the practical work, merely because the equipment is so big and so heavy and takes a tremendous amount of time simply to put up a small section of it and so on. So what we had to do with most of the courses we ran was simply to give them instruction in a certain type of bridge and let them put it up for, say, a couple of days, and then leave it and go on to something else. And our expert gang, XRE retired, took it down and put the stores away. About six or seven of them removed what about 30 young officers had put up. So it shows you how valuable practical experience is when it comes to moving heavy stuff. Well, I had two splendid... I had two splendid years there, and of course I got to know a great number of the young officers, because I had to take them all in courses during the intervals of their time at Cambridge and so on. And I found that very much of a challenge, because at Cambridge they listened to the Regius Professor of Engineering and so on, and then to come down to Chatham and be lectured to Captain R.E., who was just about your own age, it took a bit of doing in a way. However, I was mainly concerned with the practicalities of bridge construction rather than the design and so on. So that wasn't too difficult. I enjoyed the time as a teacher very much indeed, though it was very hard work, because I was trying to work for the staff college at the same time. However, I managed to get a nomination for that at the end of my, well, getting near the end of my time at Chatham, and I joined the staff college at the beginning of 1937 and did the what used to be the standard two-year course there. And that, of course, I enjoyed immensely. You met all sorts of chaps there, and though the average age, I suppose, was about 33, which was really much too old for the initial staff training. Most of us, before we got there, had sort of grade three appointments or assistant instructor or adjutant, something like that. And a lot of the first half year was used up in getting everybody onto the same basis, because we had, of course, quite a number from the Dominions, the Indian Army, and a few foreigners, such as Iraq Army, Egyptian Army, and so on. And until you got practically everybody on the same basic footing as regards tactics and so on, it wasn't really much good in proceeding with further instruction. However, I enjoyed it immensely, and one of the difficulties was, as I say, when you first went there, you spent what seemed an awful lot of time rather wasted in going back to the beginning. And when you finished your course and your last half year there had been dealing with warfare at a very high level, attending defence committee meetings and so on, and mostly with the your opposite numbers at Greenwich and the RAF Staff College at Andover, and having done all that and conducted warfare at a very high level, you then found yourself normally posted back to a grade 3 appointment, which was an awful waste of time. Fortunately, at the time when I had qualified, which was at the end of 1938, the war was quite obviously on the horizon, and the army was expanding, and staff appointments were increasing, and I think nearly all of us went into a grade 2 appointment straight off. I mean, our first staff appointment. But there was one omission there. You were normal times expected to do about a year back at regimental duty after you'd passed Staff College with the very laudable object of passing on what you'd learnt to the other officers of your unit. The up-to-date tactical thinking, possible improvements in weapons and all that sort of thing, which an ordinary unit doesn't get to know of unless somebody comes and tells them. But we unfortunately missed all that and had to go straight from Staff College, or within a month or two, into a regimental a staff appointment. I did a 2 months in Gibraltar in a fortress company, which was quite good fun, a thing I knew very little about. And then I got my posting to the War Office, and I found myself doing a job which nobody knew very much about, and that was the organizing of what you might call extramural activities, or what we would call guerrilla warfare, I suppose, now. And we planned, it was a small section in the G branch of the War Office, headed up by two officers who both became extremely distinguished at the end of the war. And we did the sort of planning for various nefarious deeds, such as blowing up the Romanian oil fields, various hydroelectric plants in Italy, and various other things of that sort. Now, planning of a thing like that could be fairly easily done by with the assistance of local experts, like people in the Shell Company for oil fields and so on. But when you came to lay on the organization that were going to do it, then you were up against an absolute brick wall. Because if you went to the G staff and said, look here, we will want couple of field companies ready to do this particular job, or one field company, if you like, they would say, oh, but they can't do that. That's a job for the Secret Service to do. And if you went to them and said, what about it, they would say, oh, we can't organize anything for that in peacetime because it might prejudice our organization for collecting information. So
there's nobody available to carry out such.
Well, so they thought. So we immediately thought, as I say, the two chaps who were running our thing were of high calibre, and they said, nonsense. If nobody's going to do it, we'll do it. And so we thereupon started running courses for civilian chaps who were with no military background at all. And they were told that if war was to come, they would be commissioned at once, and they would have to do a little bit of military training, about a week, in order that they could handle things when they met other soldiers. But we undertook the training of them in explosive and demolitions and all that nonsense. And we had a very remarkable engineer officer in the branch who was our sort of devices expert, I suppose you'd call him. Terribly inventive brain. He's one of these rare chaps who can get an idea and translate it into springs and metal and electric currents and that sort of thing. Marvellous chap. His name was Minnis Jeffries, and he was responsible for any number of things like delayed action switches and things for dealing with the what was the mines that used to attach themselves to ships?
Limpet mines.
Limpet mines, those sort of things. He was evolved ways of dealing with them and so on.
Didn't he invent the sticky bomb?
Yes, yes. I spent quite a time on several cold afternoons throwing the beastly things at tanks to see if they would stick. Much to everybody's amusement, the tanks, because it was so cold, they wouldn't work at all. Eventually they were all right. And so that occupied me from about May 1939 until the war broke out.
How did you recruit these civilians that you were training in sabotage?
On the old boy network, largely. They were various people that were quite well known. Peter Fleming was one, whom you've probably heard about. Geoffrey Household, who was quite a well-known author of thrillers. I don't know whether he's still alive or not. But he was another. And
what sort of man were you looking for when you recruited them? How did you select them?
Fairly young. Knowledge of particular foreign countries, essential. Simply by finding out from somebody who they knew who might suit. It was very much a haphazard business because we dare not advertise it, even to the general staff, except on an extremely high level. We had to do that or we wouldn't get any money.
Who were you working for then? Who was in charge of your particular...
Our particular section? Well, we had two, really. One was Joe Holland, who was a sapper, and he gained a high reputation as a pilot in the First World War, actually, though he was an engineer officer. And the other was a fellow called Gubbins, who was a gunner, and they were both reckoned as grade one. They were lieutenant colonels and so on. And very well in on the higher reaches of the War Office, which I was completely ignorant of. And the sort of actual work of the section, as we were pleased to call it, was done by myself from the Army side. A fellow called Watson, who finished up as a vice admiral in the naval side, and John Walter, who was a director of the Times.
Who are you working to ultimately? Were you under the director of military operations, or...?
Let me see, it was... Yes. I think he was the only chap who knew what we were doing, that and his... well, of course, we didn't have an equivalent of that on the Army Council in those days. because the CIGS, I suppose the vice chief of the CIGS, he would be our immediate sort of contact with the exalted. But the DOP certainly knew what was happening, because again we had to get his weight if we wanted to get any equipment or explosives or anything like that without having to say what we wanted it for.
Where were you based? Where was your office?
The officer, well, the main office was in London.
In Whitehall?
Yeah. Well, where the devil was it? No, I think it was in Queen's. You know, I can't remember. I'm so sorry. I ought to know. But as soon as war came, we moved into the War Office main building, at least the main office did, and we had two or three little workshops, really, in London, which Jeffries, our devices officer, used to run, and they simply made the things that he was trying out.
Who actually selected the targets for which you were making plans?
Oh, that was done by DOPS. And I think very much on our suggestions, not mine particularly, but Holland and Gubbins and so on, who the head of our little branch, who'd studied it out, I mean, from a point of view of helping the military plan. I mean, for instance, they would find out from GOPS what they proposed to do if Italy came into the war, and then sat down and said, well, now, how can we break up this?
Were the targets primarily military, or were they economic?
They weren't military at all at that stage, because we didn't really know where the military depots and things were. But we did know where the oil fields were and where the hydroelectric stations were and so on. I mean, MI6 produced that for us.
So presumably the Joint Intelligence Committee knew you were...
Well, they knew we existed, yes.
Was your concern mainly with training?
Well, it was both, really. Take one example that I remember well, because it lasted for quite a long time, and that was the demolition of the Romanian oil fields, assuming the Germans would get there before anything we could do could stop them. We had to make some sort of plan as to what to do and who was going to do it. And unfortunately, there was only one purely British company there, and they were we got to know the chap who was the managing director very well. His father had won a DSO for blowing them up in the First World War, so he knew roughly the forms, you might say. But the thing was full of Germans, which was very awkward. And the Romanians were anxious, I think, to keep on the side of the French in those up to the